Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Barry Eisler, whose latest book is Requiem for an Assassin. Earlier books include The Last Assassin, Killing Rain, three other John Rayne novels. Barry Eisler spent 3 years in the CIA's Directorate of Operations, which we'll go into. You did not disclose that for a long time when you were a writer, correct?
That's right.
John Rayne is an assassin. He's a mercenary assassin. You invented him, apparently, after you left the CIA. You had an image of two men walking down a street. Is that correct?
That's right. I was living in Tokyo at the time. It was 1993. And an image came to me of two men following another man down the street in a part of the city called Shibuya. I wasn't there at the time. This was just in my imagination. It was such a vivid, powerful image that I started asking myself questions about it. I mean, well, who are these guys? Why are they following that other man? And then answers started to come. I thought, nah. They're assassins. They're going to kill him. But that answer only led to more questions. Who hired them? What did the guy do? Why are they trying to kill him? Where did they come from? How do you become a freelance contract killer?
And at that particular time, you had not written a novel, but you'd done writing in college.
I've always been writing something, and every company I've ever worked at, including the government and the private sector, I've always become known as the guy to go to if you need something written, whether it's marketing collateral, a business plan, advertising, whatever. It didn't really matter what my job description was. So I've always liked to write. But yeah, Rainfall was my first attempt at a novel.
And in choosing a hero who's an assassin, you know immediately you're going to have a problem because a contract assassin is cold, real cold.
Yeah, you have to get people past the obvious fact of the bad things he does to get them to sympathize with him. But we know it's not impossible. I mean, Tony Soprano is the greatest contemporary example of a sympathetic, likable character that you're actually cheering for, even though he's a very bad man.
Well, they also have Donald Westlake's Richard Stark books.
Another great example.
As well. Okay, so you've got this character. You've got the two people walking down the streets. One is Rayne, and who's the other?
The other is a guy who was helping him in that book, a young Japanese computer nerd guy in Japan they would call an otaku. He's a geek. He stays at home all the time, and he's just good with hacking. As it turned out in the book, the second guy, Harry, isn't an assassin. He helps Rayne, and he doesn't really know exactly what Rayne's doing. He thinks he's some kind of private investigator, which up until a point you can think of Rayne as being. He just goes a little farther than your average PI.
Now, at that point, you've got the characters, and you begin to see the plot. Are you going, I'm writing a novel, what's going on here? What's going on in your head at that point?
For me, it was a question and answer process where, again, every answer led to more questions, which, by the way, is the way any good story should work. I mean, the writer spools out information. It draws you into the story by making you hungry for more information. At some point, after playing with this for a few months, it started to be complex and interesting enough so that I thought that this story is longer and more intricate than I first thought. This could actually be a novel if I stick with it.
And there was a point where you decided this guy is half Japanese, half American, but he looks Japanese.
That's right. Yeah, it was the experience of living in Japan and being a visitor there, which was very comfortable for me, even though at the time I was pretty fluent in Japanese. It was still very comfortable for me to be treated as a visitor. I started wondering, what would it be like to be treated like a visitor here if you didn't think you were a visitor? And from that question, his bicultural, biracial identity started to take shape.
How about the backstory that he was in Vietnam, that he went through a lot of killing, all of that? How did that emerge? Just serendipitously?
Two things, really. One is that I have a longstanding interest in the American experience in Vietnam. It was in college, I read a lot about it, just on my own. And as I started to form Rayne's background, again, by asking myself all these questions, where did a guy like this come from? I mean, how does somebody become a contract killer? Does he start as an accountant or a lawyer? I doubt it. It's got to be someone who's had some early inculcation with violence. There are a number of ways you might get that, but the most obvious is through the military. So I started thinking it makes sense that this guy would have a military past. Because I knew a lot, relatively speaking, about Vietnam at the time, it was natural for me to imagine him as having had experience in Vietnam.
When you wrote that book, as you were working on it, were you thinking of this as a standalone at that particular
point?
Yeah.
The first book I had conceived of is only a standalone. And in fact, I was working on a second novel when my agent sold the rights to Rainfall in the U.S. and in 9 foreign countries, and everybody wanted a sequel. That was when I first started saying, I guess I could write a sequel. And now I look back and I can't believe I didn't spot the series potential here, because this character is, I think each book has been better than the last. The character gets more and more complex, more and more layers get stripped away. I can't imagine that this character would have been done justice to with only one book.
On the other hand, it means you have to live with him for X number of years.
As long as he's amenable, I am too.
Well, okay, you've got that, and then you begin thinking, okay, what's the second book? Now, what I've noticed as the books progress is that the backstory and the history becomes more complex, so that the books, while they can be read alone, become less standalone.
I guess it depends. When people ask me, do I need to read them in order, I always say, no, you don't. And I know that lots of people read them out of order, and any one of them will function as a standalone. But probably the most satisfying way to read the series is from the very beginning. Although, as long as you read them all, I'm happy.
Part of that is that one of the old standard questions we asked back in the days when this was a mystery show was, how do you keep a character fresh? Right. And it's a real problem when you're taking a character, moving him this direction or that. But, of course, when you've got the momentum of a backstory, whether it be John Rayne or Tony Soprano, it kind of builds on itself.
Yeah, as long as that backstory, as long as the character's history is in some way intersecting with what's going on in the world for him right now. For me, it's mostly about taking the character outside his comfort zone. Because if he's in his comfort zone, he's not going to do anything all that. He's not going to be that interesting. He's good. We know what he can do in that zone. We've seen it before. Put him in situations where he's off his game and see how he handles it. And that, for me, is electrifying.
And then there's also, you can bring in various current events and your own political position, though that shouldn't be the primary focus.
No. There are all sorts of books. I mean, I guess there could be novels that are driven more by the writer's political views. But for me, it's all about the story. Although I am, just as a person, I am a news junkie and very political. There is some politics in the book, but you would expect that from a guy as cynical as John Rayne. Of course he's going to have an opinion.
At a certain point, when you look at Rayne, how much of Barry Eisler is Rayne, and how much of Rayne is Barry Eisler?
Well, we share some surface similarities. We both like good single malt whiskey. We're both into martial arts, although he's much better than I have a first-degree black belt from the Kodokan in Tokyo. Rayne's been doing judo for 25-plus years and a bunch of other martial arts, too. We both like jazz clubs and jazz. Beyond that, he's a much more cynical and even bitter guy than I am. I tend to be a fairly optimistic guy by nature, but Rayne has had some experiences, some really searing experiences that I have mercifully not had to have. And those experiences have produced his persona. The best way to answer this question for me is, have you seen the movie Heist? David Mamet wrote it.
Years ago, yeah.
It's a terrific movie. There's a line where Gene Hackman's a criminal, and another criminal asks him admiringly, he says, about a caper Hackman pulled. He says, how did you think of that? And Hackman says, oh, it's not so hard, really. I just imagine a guy who's smarter than I am and ask, what would he do? And that's how I write Rayne.
That's also, in looking at your website, BarryEisler.com, it seems like how you treat plots themselves. What would someone do, and then what would someone do if they knew what someone was doing, almost like a chess game.
Which is almost the definition of a character-driven plot, and to me the best stories are going to be character-driven.
In Requiem for an Assassin, you would set up beforehand that he now had one friend, the sniper Docs, and that he had a girlfriend.
Right.
Going into that, what else did you know? Did you know at that point that you'd be reusing the same villain from the previous novel?
No. I usually start almost every time I start the book by just thinking, all right, based on what has happened in the previous book, what would these characters be doing now? What would be their hopes, their fears? What would they be trying to accomplish? Where would they be living? All that kind of stuff. And from the answers to those questions, a plot will start to unspool.
And how far do you get in the plot before you realize you have to pull out some bucks and start traveling?
It depends on the book. For example, The Last Assassin, the previous book, I needed to go to Barcelona early. My friends are listening to this. They're going to say, yeah, you needed to go to Barcelona.
Yeah, right. I need to go to Barcelona, too. Yeah.
I knew the book opened in Barcelona, where Rayne and Delilah were going to meet to try to sort. She's a Mossad agent, and so it's an uneasy romance. They needed to meet on neutral territory and try to figure out what's going on between them. So I didn't go there with so much specific purpose. I just needed to kind of walk in their footsteps and see what's going on in their worlds. Other times I go with a much more specific itinerary. For the fourth book, for example, Killing Rayne, there was a sequence that I knew was going to take shape in Manila, where Rayne goes to kill a target and blows the hit, and then all sorts of bad things happen. And then from that, the entire plot unspools. I needed to see the layout in Manila because I had to be John Rayne going to Manila on an assignment. How would he approach it? Where would the hit take place? All that kind of stuff.
In this book, did that mean you went to the Singapore Yacht Club?
Yeah, and in fact, every place I write about, I go there personally. So for this book, I know I don't want you to feel sorry for me, but I did go in this book to Paris, Saigon, Amsterdam, Rotterdam, New York, of course, and the other locations in the book, Bali as well.
And the places that he goes to are all real places, then?
Every place in the book is real, and in fact, for anyone who's curious, if you go to my website, barryeisler.com, there's a link called Photos. Go to the photo section. You can see photos I've taken of all the locations and find the addresses and contact information of all the bars and whiskey clubs and coffee clubs that Rain like.
My family is from New York,
right,
and I know Middle Neck Road pretty well.
That's cool.
And I've been up to Sands Point. Does the house that he stakes out at Sands, does that house exist? How do you fake that stuff?
I don't.
Do you know who lives there?
No, but I didn't use an address.
I mean,
you know, I don't want somebody to get that upset. But I gave the street name.
There are a lot of writers who will say it doesn't matter if it's real as long as it feels real.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
I think it's certainly true. It's all the kind of book you're trying to write. If I think of my books as having a brand, and they do. I think all products have brands. My books certainly do. Probably the core of my brand is realism. And so it's important for me to establish a level of trust with my readers about everything in the books being real. It's not just the places that I take so much care with, but also the action sequences are based on my own martial arts background. The spy craft, the operator mindset, that's all of what I learned and experienced when I was with the CIA. And the plots are often taken from today's headlines. I try to think of my books as driven by fictional characters being dropped into non-fictional circumstances, places and circumstances, and that's my brand.
You were trained in small arms, long arms, hand-to-hand, explosives, surveillance, counter-surveillance. All of that finds its way into your book.
That was all just high school in New Jersey, yeah. The CIA was the advanced stuff. Yeah, it does. All the training, not just in the paramilitary training, which is a separate school at the CIA, but yeah, also the field tradecraft course, this 20-week spy school course, which is all about how to recruit and maintain a clandestine relationship. That all appears in the books as well.
And the judo, jiu-jitsu, all of the holds that the characters do throughout is all?
Everything. And it's my great privilege to know a lot of guys who are much, much better in martial arts than I'll ever be. I have a lot of real-world experience with violence, too, and they help me choreograph the sequences.
One of the things about the whole James Bond thing is Q, hands,
right.
Mr. Bond, all of these gadgets, and we know that some gadgets are real and some are phony and some fake it. People fake it to a greater or lesser degree.
Right.
Now, you're saying that you don't fake it or try not to, though there is a slight disclaimer here.
Right.
There's a gun that boils people's skin. This exists?
Oh, yeah. It's called an area denial system. You can Google it. Its intended purpose is crowd control. It's essentially a giant open-air microwave that boils the moisture in your skin 1/16th of an inch below the surface. It's just been deployed in Iraq, by the way. So the feeling you get from this is it's as though you've touched a hot light bulb, except it's your whole body. It's unbearable, and anybody who feels it will immediately flee the area. The only change I made was to make it more portable and to make it able to go through walls. And as I said in a disclaimer at the end of the book, I'm not sure if there's yet a system that's as portable or able to go through walls as the one in this book.
Have you met anybody who experienced it?
No, I wish I had, and this is one thing I wasn't able to try on myself. I really do try. There are stun gun sequences in the books, and I have actually hit myself with a stun gun just to see. Kids don't try this at home. These are trained professionals. But no, I don't know if I'd really want to be in the way of an area denial system.
What about the suit that Rain wears towards
dragon
the end
skin?
Of the book? Yeah,
it's funny. There's an article in New York Times where it turns out that dragon skin, which is a ballistic suit, it's like ballistic underwear, long underwear. Think of it like that. It's very flexible.
Have you seen it?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
I know it exists. I've read about it.
Right.
And there was an article saying that it seems superior to what the Pentagon is issuing our troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. So you can imagine there's some controversy about that. This stuff does exist, and it can stop a high-powered rifle round.
You're listening to an interview with Barry Eisler, whose latest book is Requiem for an Assassin. Barry Eisler, you spent 3 years in the CIA's Directorate of Operations. You were going for a law degree before then? Or?
I had my law degree.
I
graduated from Cornell Law School in 89 and then joined the CIA.
Why would you join the CIA? What were your politics at the time?
I don't know that I was particularly political at the time, although I had become very interested in the world about halfway through college and started reading obsessively a lot of foreign affairs, New York Times, Wall Street Journal. You can get the idea. And I'd always been interested in what you might think of as the secret world, espionage, that sort of thing. So it seemed like a natural confluence of interests for me.
This was the Bush years. Bush won.
Yeah, it was the Berlin Wall was coming down just as I went in, and then the first Iraq War, yeah.
When you went in, they did a big background search, that whole bit?
Yeah, there's it takes a little while. It wasn't that hard for me because I hadn't lived abroad. But, right, you first have to take a written exam, which is about your knowledge of foreign affairs, that sort of thing. And then a series of psychological exams, and then a polygraph, and then they start sending the retired Navy guys around to talk to your neighbors and former college roommates. They talked to my former college roommates. I'm amazed I got the job, but what can I say?
At the time, you know, the CIA didn't have that great a reputation. A lot of people were pretty scared of the CIA, and, you know, we knew about what had happened in Nicaragua and all that. None of that was in your consciousness?
No. I think that all nations will need intelligence services. An intelligence service, in my mind, is a tool, almost like a gun is a tool. It depends on how it's used. Whether it's good or evil all depends on how it's used. So, no, I didn't look at the CIA as inherently good or inherently evil, but rather as necessary. And as an interested and hopefully honorable man, I had no qualms about trying to become a part of it.
When you went in, did you know what area you wanted to be in?
Oh, yeah, I wanted to be in the DO, the Directorate of Operations. I wanted to be a spy, not an analyst or anything like that.
As you were being trained, how did it compare to everything that you'd read about being a spy?
I think the training was probably more or less in line with what I had expected. There was a 7-week paramilitary course called the SOTSI, Special Operations Training Course. Think of it as Outward Bound with Guns. That was the most fun I've ever been paid to have in my life.
What did they do?
Everything you can imagine. This is the part of my bio you're reading about small arms, long arms. I mean, everything. Right. All kinds of weapons. We learned how to use an M79 grenade launcher, improvised explosive devices, airdrops to friendly forces. That was a lot of fun. Small watercraft. Just name anything that has to do with paramilitary. 7 weeks, and we just ran around in the field and shot things and blew things up, and it was a lot of fun.
You became 15 years old again.
But, you know, they won't let you do those things when you're 15. That was the best part.
Okay, so you got trained. Now, what about the other training in terms of political awareness, in terms of surveillance, in terms of learning to keep your mouth shut, in terms of dealing with being interrogated?
You know, in some ways, I think there are two analogs that help people understand what it's like to be a case officer, an intelligence officer. One is, if you know what it's like to be a salesman, you'll have a certain idea because you're trying to persuade someone to do something that that you want them to do. It has a lot of the skill sets. There's a lot of crossover between the skill sets of a good salesman and a good case officer. The other way to understand what a case officer is doing in the field is to think of it as having an affair. Everything a case officer has to do and keep in mind while maintaining this clandestine relationship is certainly someone who's having some kind of extramarital affair is going to have to do, too. All the concepts you think about, dead drops and clandestine meetings and cover for action, all the concepts are the same. It's just institutionalized and put in an intelligence setting.
So you have to become a really consummate liar.
Yes. You're living a cover. If someone asks you what you do, you have to be able to lie about that. And not only at a high level like that, you have to have a lie ready because you're going to be in places doing things that you're not supposed to do. And if you get discovered, you have to have a story. Rain actually talks about this in the new book, yeah. Requiem for an Assassin.
Yeah, and he was having a lot of qualms. And I'm thinking right. He's a fictional character having qualms about becoming a full-time liar.
Right.
What was going on in your mind as you were learning this?
Well, it was just something that had to be done if you want to be effective in the job.
Did you actually go out in the field after you were trained?
I didn't spend much time in the field. And, in fact, my frustration at waiting for that field assignment is part of what prompted me to leave the CIA and find my way to Japan on my own.
Did they train you in Japanese at the time?
Yeah, I spent about a year of full-time Japanese language study.
And you were there for 3 years now.
Right.
Sometime around the time you left was the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center.
Yeah, that was afterward, right.
That was afterward. When you were there, how compartmentalized is the CIA in terms of what you learn? Is there any scuttlebutt going around about different political issues?
Yeah, any organization, there's always going to be corridor talk, probably
right.
Less in the CIA because you have to be so careful, but it's a very political place, so in terms of internal office kind of politics and also politics in the world, so sure, people talk.
And they also know who are the good guys out there in the political world and who are the people who are, rather than saying bad guys, kind of stupid.
They certainly have a lot of opinions, yeah, as you would expect.
Would those opinions match the opinions, say, of people in Berkeley, or would they match the opinions of people in Kansas?
In my experience, there was a fairly broad mix there. I know that the agency has a reputation for being a liberal place and drawing from the ranks of Ivy League institutions and things like that. But judging mostly from my own class, I felt like there was a fairly broad spectrum of political views.
You leave the CIA and you go out into the world and you go to Japan, you study in Japan. Meanwhile, you're watching what's going on in the world. I spoke with a former CIA agent who'd written a novel. I spoke with her in February 2001, and I said to her, not knowing what she'd say, I said, well, what's the biggest danger facing the U.S.? And I was told terrorism, and I was told specifically they're going to do something. They've tried it before. They will try it again. In light of that and watching what happened on 9/11, at the time, what was your take on all this?
It depends on how you look at the question.
Okay.
If you talk about an external threat, I agree that today the greatest external threat to America would be one of these jihadist groups smuggling weapons of mass destruction, particularly something like a suitcase nuke, into an American city and setting it off. But taking a step back and looking at it another way, there are internal dangers, as I see it, in the way that America is dealing with that potential threat. We've known it's out there for a long time. Societies are like organisms. Organisms have reflexes. America's reflex when we're poked is to hit back, and that typically means militarily. Abroad means the military, at home it means security. I'm not even going to say it's a good thing or a bad thing. It's just the way we are. We need to get past that. The military and security are tools. They're not necessarily the most appropriate tools for dealing with this kind of threat. And until we open our eyes a little bit and start using some more out-of-the-box tools than the ones we've been using, then I don't think we're doing what we need to do to properly counter that external threat. Politically, the Bush administration benefited enormously from 9/11.
Sure.
Okay. Almost unavoidably. I mean, anytime there's trauma, national trauma, the country will rally around the president. The president happened to be a Republican at the time. So I'm not saying this in any kind of that Bush did anything to far us up until this point. It's just inevitable. You have to be careful about going one step further, which is to say because a certain party benefited from an event, that party must have done something either by omission or commission to precipitate that event. Then you get into conspiracy theories. Bush was handed historic political capital after 9/11. There were unbelievable directions that he could have taken the country in to make the country safer. I think all Americans were willing to sacrifice. Everything was on the table. I mean, you name it, and it could have been implemented right then. And instead of going in any of those creative directions, using that historic opportunity to do anything new, Bush did what was reflexive, which was he used the fear to take America to war, and did none of the other things that would have actually made us safer. And the results, I think, from that experiment are now in.
Barry Eisler, when you began hearing about the Valerie Plame story, having been a covert agent, what were your thoughts?
The Valerie Plame thing looks to me like a classic case of the cover-up being worse than the crime. This is my take on it. When Joe Wilson published that op-ed, or had that op-ed published in the New York Times saying that there was no yellow cake, there was, in other words, Hussein had no weapons of mass destruction, no nukes. The New York Times lands on the vice president's desk that morning. He sees the op-ed and he says, who the hell is this guy, Joe Wilson? What's going on here? And they find out what's happened and they, well, who sent this guy to Niger? What is he? Said, well, his wife works at the CIA. And they said, well, wait a minute. If his wife sent him, we can impeach his credibility, just like a lawyer will try to impeach the credibility of a witness. By spinning this as something, it was some junket. It's a case of nepotism. The guy's not an expert. Nobody should take him seriously. His wife got him the job. It's a demeaning way to spin the guy. That's just hardball politics. So far, so good. And you would expect any administration, all administrations play the game this way. So they got excited. They said, yeah, we can undercut this guy's credibility. They leaked the news that he got the job through his wife. And then they said, oh, wait a second. Oh, my God, his wife, she's covert. Oops. All they had to do at this point was apologize the next day. As soon as the questions came up, they didn't have to be quite as direct as I just was, but they should have said, look, this is what happened. We wanted people to know how we got the job. It's important for people to know the full story. And we lost sight of the fact, and we want to apologize to all the nation's covert operators and specifically to Ms. Plame. That would have been the end of the story that day. But instead, they decided to lie and stonewall. That's the cover-up, and the cover-up's what always kills you.
The same thing happened in a way with the attorneys, what they did was stepping over a lot of lines, but they could have gotten away with
it. Exactly right. They did nothing illegal with it. And I love this phrase when people say, the attorneys general serve at the pleasure of the president. It always makes you feel like, I'd like to have people serving at my pleasure. It's got to be a great, it sounds like he's a sultan or some sort of satrap or something. But right, it is completely within the president's prerogative to fire the attorney generals for any reason he wants. But he may have to pay a political price for it.
And they
the mistake they
that.
Made, exactly, is they wanted to exercise the right without paying the political price, and so they lied. And it's the lies that are killing them.
Well, but I also think, and after having read Imperial Life in the Emerald City and spoken with several people, various people in various elements of politics, from Joe Connison to Bill Bradley, you know, what you wind up coming down to is that all of this is part of the same piece.
Right.
You know, you can't really say, okay, they could have done it right this way.
Right.
And they could have done it right that way, and they didn't do this, and they did the cover-up, and all they would have had to do. But in fact, the same reasoning that went into one decision went into all decisions.
Again and again. And in fact, there's a telling story. I don't know if you'll remember it because it didn't stick around that long, but immediately after 9/11, it took Bush a while, if you remember, to get back to the White House. And so there were questions at the time. You know, what's taking so long? Where's the president?
Yeah.
And then reporters started asking the White House spokesman, I think it was Ariel Fleischer at the time, so where was the president? And instead of telling the truth, and the truth really wasn't bad. The truth basically was, look, we didn't know what was going on, and we were overcautious. We moved him around too much. In retrospect, we should have gotten back to the White House right away. Sorry. That would have been the end of the story, and nobody would have cared. The country was just tell us what to do. Instead, they didn't want to admit that they'd done even the most minor peccadillo. So they said, we received evidence of a credible threat to the president's life. And so we had to move him, and we couldn't say where he was. And that's why it took so long to get him back to the White House. And of course, they made it up out of whole cloth. And so reporters started asking about it. And then the lies got deeper and deeper. And it was over this silly thing. And you can judge from something like that in an administration, just as you can judge with a person. When someone lies about some stupid thing that didn't even require a lie, you know you're dealing with a liar. And to me, that instinct to lie, even when there's no reason to lie, seems to be in the DNA of this administration.
Barry Eisler, there's mention in Requiem for an Assassin about the privatization of intelligence rendition. When you were in the CIA, did they even think in those terms?
I don't know enough to say. I was only there for 3 years, and I was at a fairly junior level, and my responsibilities were Japan, where I hope the United States isn't rendering too many people out of that part of the world. I think that there have always been and there always will be certain things done in the shadows of any democracy that citizens really don't want to know about and arguably shouldn't know about. It's unfortunate. It's a breach of our ideals, but I'm afraid it's reality. The problem with this administration is that rather than conducting these sorts of operations in an extremely limited, discreet fashion, they tried to institutionalize it and made it way too broad. As a result, the operations themselves became useless, and they're even hamstrung now from doing these things in the limited, discreet, extraordinarily careful way that might have been useful in the first instance.
And torture itself. I talked to Gail Linz, who does her own research for a spy novel.
Sure.
She said torture is always useless. The thought of using torture to get information is counterproductive.
I think that we should generally treat torture as being useless. And I think we can see that the results from experiments, if you want to think of them that way, at places like Abu Ghraib are in. But I don't know that I would make a blanket statement of saying torture is always useless. There'll be certain people, there'll be certain circumstances where it could produce a limited useful result. That doesn't mean that you should do it in itself. But sometimes these arguments get so polarized that, for example, just because you find torture abhorrent, as I do, you don't have to run ahead of the logic by saying, because I find it abhorrent, I have to take a position that it could never possibly be useful. One doesn't follow from the other. It may be that torture could possibly be useful. We should acknowledge that. That doesn't mean we should do it. There are a lot of other considerations, including our humanity, our standing in the world, our soft power, how the use of torture corrupts the men who do it and the other men around them, as we've seen again from Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. There are a lot of other considerations. I have to say, I think it's a little bit simplistic to just say, the reason we shouldn't torture is because it never works. You know what? If it really never, ever worked, it probably would never, ever be used.
Barry Eisler, on your website, you talk about 10 tips for being a writer, which I don't want to go into. They're great tips, and I've hit them one after another, writer after writer.
Great.
You also talk about being smarter than the criminal, always trying to outthink what would they do. And I was thinking about that, and I realized that in any argument, it's the same thing. If you try to come up with what the other person is going to do, you can counter it earlier.
Know thy enemy.
This was stuff that was taught to you in the CIA?
Yeah, some of it was in counterterrorist training. I mean, the most important thing that you have to be able to do if you're trying to protect yourself from becoming a victim of a crime or a terrorist act or anything like that, the most important thing is first to understand the mind of your enemy, their tactics. I mean, if you were a terrorist, put yourself in the terrorist shoes or the criminal shoes, what would you do? And I give a fun talk at a lot of crime fiction conventions. It's because it's interactive. I ask people, look, are you afraid of being mugged in this room? People say, no, they're not. And I say, well, where are you afraid of being mugged? And they say, well, in a parking lot late at night. I said, look, you're already doing it. You're already thinking like a criminal. If you were a criminal, you wouldn't try to mug somebody in a crowded hotel room in broad daylight. Why? People talk about that. But you would want a dark parking lot. Why? Once you start thinking that way and understanding the mindset and the tactics of your opposition, you can avoid those places and circumstances and much better protect yourself.
You make mention of people running out of their cars with the engine running.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, things like that.
Classic case.
Yeah.
And criminals know. So this is another thing I ask people at this talk. I said, look, if you need a car really fast, you need to steal a car, how do you do it? Somebody always raises a hand and says, hotwire the ignition. I say, right, does anyone here know how to do that? No other hands go up. I go, okay, that's not going to work. So you need to steal a car. You need the keys. Where do you go? And people very quickly, they say, the dry cleaner, Blockbuster Video, places where people think, oh, I'll just be in and out in 30 seconds. How long does it take to get in a car with the engine running and drive off? A lot less than 30 seconds.
So it must be fun to write a character like John Rain who knows all of that and will always take advantage of it.
It's one of the things that's made Rain the survivor he is. He's superb at thinking like the opposition, anticipating their tactics, and outmaneuvering them.
At the very end of the book, he doesn't quite do it, though.
Nobody's perfect. And if he were some kind of Superman, then it wouldn't be fun. And that's another challenge for me writing him. He's so much smarter than I am, and I still have to find a way where he can be fooled. Otherwise, the books wouldn't be so much fun.
Barry Eisler, after all of these Rain books, I came to the end of this one. I said, you know, after this, I could see the series becoming dull for you because you've kind of reached a point where if you begin doing it, you start repeating yourself.
Yeah, I've been afraid of that every step of the way, and so far it hasn't happened, I'm really glad to say. I'm taking a break from Rain for my next book. The next one will be a standalone thriller. For my eighth book, which will be out 2 years from now, I just got this wild hair of an idea that I really like, and I think it's going to become a John Rain prequel novel, because there are certain things about him that are established or hinted at in the books, all having to do with his background, his formative experiences. And I started thinking about where did those things about Rain come from? And I think there's a very interesting story in there. I'd like to tell it.
The problem with that, though, goes back to Hannibal Rising, which is that once you reveal too much, then the mystique disappears.
It's so true. It depends on the character, and it depends on the way the author does it. So, yeah, Hannibal Lecter is a character we shouldn't know too much about. The guy is almost magic. He's pure evil, and in fact, in one of the earlier books, I think it was Silence of the Lambs, he says, don't try to explain me. I'm not explainable. And that's Hannibal. We like him like that. So he's the wrong kind of character, in my opinion, for an origin story. Someone like Rain, who's very good, but he's certainly not magical, I think is amenable to that sort of treatment.
Well, the other problem is Rain is now, in his mid-50s. He's
getting
a little long
exactly.
in the tooth
exactly.
for this sort of thing.
Exactly. Although when people say, come on, Ray, he couldn't do that. I said, listen, I trained 6 days a week in judo at the Kodokan in Tokyo. There were guys there in their 60s who could kick my butt. That's where I get the idea. It's unusual for a guy at Rain's age to be able to do the things he does. I guarantee you it's not impossible.
These books have been optioned?
Yeah, the first three books have been optioned for film by a guy named Barry Osborne, who is the producer of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Barry and company have had that option now for almost 3 years. It expires on August 1st, unless they exercise first or I agree to renew it. So I'm not really sure what's going to happen with the option after this.
Would you consider writing the screenplay?
I did. I wrote the
really?
Screenplay. Yeah, I adapted the first book, Rainfall, and it was a blast. I love doing it. It's a completely different way of telling a story. And I loved it, and I'd love to do it again. We'll see what happens.
You've been listening to an interview with Barry Eisler, whose latest book is Requiem for an Assassin. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.